Strategy and Insider, exploring future trends and their impacts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Strategy and Insider podcast, where we discuss the pivotal questions shaping the future of healthcare. Thank you for tuning in today. I'm Thomas, your host and a partner in the pharma life science practice at Strategy End, which is PwC's global strategy consulting business. Joining me today is a renowned healthcare expert, C-level executive, author, and a podcaster himself, which makes this episode all the more special. I'm therefore absolutely thrilled to introduce Dr. Hadi Salih, who serves as the CEO of Ceramtech since 2018, which is a leading provider of advanced ceramics for medical applications and also a multitude of other fields. Hadi himself is a trained physician and joined the firm in 2015 as their chief operating officer, where he was responsible for the medical application segment. In November last year, 24, he resumed this role as president of medical in addition to his CEO position. And prior to joining Ceramtech, he held significant roles within US medtech company Biomed. In addition to his role as the CEO, Hadi is the host of the weekly German podcast Mission Gesundheit, which more or less translates into Mission Health. In this podcast, he explores topics like future medicine, medtech, longevity, prevention, but also innovative research. And in October 24, he actually also published his book under the very same title, Mission Gesundheit, in which he offers insights into the principles of healthy aging by leveraging expertise that he has in medicine, but also analyzing his own health data. Hadi holds a medical degree from the Johannes Gutenberg University in Mainz and began his career as an orthopedic surgeon at the St. Joseph's Hospital in Wiesbaden and the University Clinic in Heidelberg. Having said that, I'm very delighted to sit down with such a versatile but also very recognized expert in healthcare. And once again, Hadi, thanks very much for joining me here in sunny Berlin today.
Thank you for having me.
So as just alluded, you are a studied physician who turned into business execution and executive roles afterwards. Roughly 20 years ago, you actually transitioned from practice in medicine into such a managerial role. And today you oversee the production of implants that you once used also in surgery yourself as a surgeon. So first of all, do you ever miss the days as a doctor when you worked there? And what inspired you in the end 20 years back to make that fundamental career shift?
Yeah, it was without going into too much detail, a series of frustrations and disappointments. I was not happy the way things played out in the hospital. And maybe I was a little bit naive back then, but I decided I needed to do something else. So I chose to become a consultant for a consulting firm. And the rest is history, as they say. Had a great, fantastic career at that firm, joined the pharmaceutical firm Merck in Darmstadt back then, who had a joint venture with Biomed. So in the end, I stayed 14 years with Biomed and the last 3 years in the headquarters in Warsaw, Indiana, in the Midwest. And since, roughly 10 years, I'm with Ceramtech and it's been a wild ride. Do I miss surgery? Sometimes. The first year was difficult, but I have overcome this, and I'm still associated with medical devices and seeing my former colleagues, so it's good for me.
And how does your that particular practical background that you have in medicine help you steer your company, which obviously is invested in healthcare, but also beyond? And how do you ensure that it is future-proof with regard to also innovation in healthcare in particular?
That's a very, very good question. I'm not sure if I ensure that we're future-proof with so many things being in flux at the moment. You know, geopolitically, it has been never so uncertain as before. Mm-hmm. You know, the war in Ukraine is not helping us in terms of, having the same levels of cheap energy. And we're an energy-intense business, so that is a challenge. The evolvement of artificial intelligence, keeps us awake, not at night, but, we We look at progression of AI in healthcare and what it does. We try to implement AI tools to be more efficient, and it's been working out great so far. So are we future-proof? I'm not sure. The future will tell. Mm-hmm. But we do our best to be as proof as possible.
And can you allude a bit which type of products or components you have in your firm? Is that highly individualized ceramics in terms of knees, artificial knees or hips, or probably give us a feel, please?
Yeah, it's roughly 55% of our business is in medical devices and and implants, of which 90% is in hips, knees, and other joints. Mm-hmm. And we provide ceramic components, so we're the tier one supplier to our OEM customers. Mm-hmm. And the remaining 45% is in industrial applications across the board, from textile components for textile machines that produce everything that we wear, thread guides, cutting tools for cutting gears in automobiles, electronic substrates for many, many, many applications. It's we're basically everywhere. And even the grinding bit in your coffee machine that grinds whole beans, mm-hmm. it's very likely from us. The park distance control in cars, you know, behind the paint is a piezo ceramic foil that emits ultrasound and receives it. It's very likely from us. Same technology, a piezo ceramic has a, you know, is a fantastic property. You apply an electric current and then it expands, not a lot, but very fast, and mm-hmm. that creates the ultrasound. And it also works the other way around. And this is how we use our technology also in PCR machines. So everybody knows what a PCR machine is after COVID. So our products are being used to break up the DNA, and then the replication cycle starts.
Got it. And in your book, Mission Health, you also vividly recount your personal health journey from peak fitness to a challenging low after 3 years in the US, actually. And upon returning to Germany, what type of lifestyle changes probably did you implement? And probably you can give us your, let's say, top three tips for prioritizing a healthy, more extended life.
Yeah, the 3 years in the US didn't serve me well. I came back heavily overweight, and unfit, and not being able to, you know, to take two flights of stairs without heavily breathing, mm-hmm. basically triggered the need to go on this journey and actually explore, you know, how can I stay as healthy as possible for as long as possible. Mm-hmm. And top three, I would say exercise. Lifting weights is number one. Number two is sleep. I'm not a religious person, but when it comes to sleep, I'm very religious and have improved my sleep routine and go to bed times and wake up times and nutrition.
Okay.
If I can add more, it's the top four is reducing stress, which is the most difficult part for me. That's mm-hmm. probably for you. Mm-hmm. And number five is social interaction and spending time outdoors. So these are the five pillars. It's exercise, lifting weights. You need to build strength next to cardio, sleep, balanced nutrition with the reduction of refined sugar. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to let go of sugar completely. It's doable, but it's it demands a lot of attention because there's hidden sugar everywhere. So if you reduce your sugar intake, that changes a lot. Mm-hmm. The biggest game changer for me when it comes to exercise was really lifting weights.
Okay.
I started running. I ran a couple of marathons, and every time I stopped with my training after the marathon where you are supposed to recover, I gained weight. So I figured out it cannot be only exercise. You know, I cannot run myself to a healthy life. So I explored, you know, all different diets. Mm-hmm. I went keto for 4 weeks, no carbohydrates. And since I love bread, pasta, rice, it was very difficult to be sustainable. Mm-hmm. And lifting weights actually upregulated my metabolism. And that helped me to, you know, maintain a balanced diet without being too dogmatic about leaving or restricting myself on food that I like, but actually upregulating my metabolism, and that helped a lot.
It's interesting that you mentioned those five, and especially the one exercising and lifting weight, because Christian Angermeyer, who we recently had also as a podcast guest, he's also very much, and we'll come to that probably later on, into longevity himself. And he also was speaking a lot about if we really want to extend life, we need to find solutions on how we preserve our muscles, also in later ages of our lives. And you can't start too late in building that muscle strength. Yeah, so kind of a confirmation that you also bring here.
Yeah? 100%.
Coming probably back to your professional life and probably also your company, as alluded before, you're not only active in healthcare, but also majority in healthcare. What from your perspective makes the healthcare sector very special when it comes to product development and innovation, because that is a major part, I assume, of your business. And linked to that, what are challenges that you personally would like to overcome that may hinder particular innovation, especially in Germany and Europe, as you also have that comparison to at least US, probably also the Asian parts. But how do you compare that, and what would you kind of take away if you could?
Yeah, the healthcare sector is largely independent of any macroeconomic changes, because we're human beings. We, regardless of the overall economic environment or geopolitical tensions, we need help when it comes to health and healthcare. So this is, it's truly special. I cannot think of any other field that is that independent of macroeconomics and or geopolitics. At the same time, it comes with the high regulatory hurdles. So it's very difficult for new entrants to come in, which, plays in our favor. We're, 40 years in the field of medical ceramics. We created a ton of data and clinical evidence that our product, performs extremely well. So this is helping us. At the same time, it's difficult because every geography has its own regulatory environment and regulatory approval process. And I wish there would be more acceptance. If you have FDA approval, why cannot the European Union accept that FDA approval and have a sort of fast track approval to an already approved product in the US? And the other way around. Same for Japan, even though Japan, builds on the CE mark that we can obtain in Europe. Similar situation in Australia. They also look at the CE mark and then have their own fast track approval process. But China is a labor intense process of obtaining regulatory approval, especially for class 3 devices like implants.
And in this healthcare sector, I'm truly believing that we are at the cusp of very fundamental change, as we're seeing disease biology understood in an unprecedented way, ability to actually measure new data points by leveraging new lab or outside of lab technologies, but also opportunities increasingly to share data across stakeholders. So there is vast majority of innovation to come that brings also effects on existing systems, right? And probably picking one, which is obviously very, very prominent in media currently, as since 23, there is new weight loss drugs out there in the market, like Ozempic from Novo Nordisk or Mounjaro from Eli Lilly. And that has brought an unprecedented boom with growth rates beyond compare. And this new class of drugs, originally developed for people with a type 2 diabetes, is mimicking a gut hormone and thereby dampening food appetite. And as an effect of these drugs, obesity rates in Western societies are supposedly declining, which could probably also lead to a decreasing demand for some medtech products, such as artificial knees or hips or sleep apnea devices and the like. How do you assess these trends and potential impacts of those developments also on your product portfolio, and how do you go about that?
So GLP-1 agonists like Ozempic, for example, or Mounjaro, I think are heaven sent. This is great for humanity, as we need to fight obesity, overweight, type 2 diabetes. Almost every week a new publication comes out that states another protective effect of those GLP-1 agonists on the brain, on the liver, on the kidneys, on basically everything. You know, mm-hmm. it seems that it's really a miracle drug. So I fully endorse that in the right hands. I don't see an application as a lifestyle drug, just to, you know, shed a couple of kilos if you're overweight and summer is coming. But for humanity, I think it's amazing. Some people think that it will have a negative effect on arthritis as well. I haven't seen that yet.
Negative effect.
Okay. Well, positive arthritis, I'm sorry. So they expect, you know, fewer indications for joint mm-hmm. replacements. I don't see that. Mm-hmm. Because as we get older and the demographics show it, 70 is the new 50. Mm-hmm. And elderly people, you know, I would call 80 and above, they still want to remain active. And in order to remain active, you know, there will be, you know, wear and tear in your joints. And as we get older and people get more active, they want to live pain-free. So there will eventually be arthritis because, you know, us humans, we never lived as long as we are today. So there won't be a negative impact by the Ozempics and the others, because usually, you know, heavily obese patients, they don't move a lot. So, you know, they're not suffering from their arthritis if they have arthritis. So the indication is really more shifting towards the active and the active elderly, 60 plus, because they want to golf, they want to hike, they want to climb Mount Everest, they want to play pickleball or paddle. And I don't foresee any change in that development on joint replacements.
That's a very good lead over. And I was alluding to that, that I had an earlier conversation with Christian Angermeyer, as he in this episode also shared his kind of fellowship as a longevity enthusiast. He shared that longevity is not about simply living longer, but also reducing the impact age has on human health, like illnesses, mental disease, or general physical status or deterioration. Mm. And he's of the opinion that we will not age the way we do today, but with significantly improved quality of life. In your opinion, how can we ensure that with a longer life and that age-related diseases are not increasing? Because ultimately this will again lead to more cost to society, more cost to the system, and this will be hard to fund, especially if there is more people to cater for, right? Yeah. So how do you balance this?
It's a very good question. I'm not sure if I have the perfect answer. Today we see in some parts of the world, an increase in obesity. Mm-hmm. And I think miracle drugs like GLP-1 agonists can cater for that specific population to reduce the overall risk of diseases. Mm-hmm. And then we have in other parts, you know, more active population. And there, you know, our products or early intervention products, sports medical products help those patients or people, not patients, to stay active longer. Mm-hmm. And the more activity you have, the better you live. And because exercise prevents many, many diseases. And you name it, you know, from diabetes, obesity, liver diseases, kidney diseases, you know, it also prevents dementia of every kind, like Alzheimer's or Lewy body disease. It's so exercise is a solution for many, many diseases. So if we find a way to provide GLP-1 agonists to heavily obese patients or people. I'm still a physician, so I keep saying patients. I'm sorry about that. people and support active people to stay as active as possible, as long as possible. This will solve for itself. Yeah. And then we have advances in modern medicine. You know, so today, for every 4 years that we live, we gain one more year. A baby or a baby that is born today is very likely to live to 100 years statistically. More on the female side, males will probably live a little bit less than 100 years without any intervention. Mm-hmm. But as medicine and research is progressing, you know, we might get to live to a state where a so-called longevity escape velocity is happening. Mm-hmm. So at some point in time, we'll gain more than a year for every year that we live. There are a couple of scientists, especially in the US, that foresee that in the next 15 to 20 years, we might to get to see this longevity escape velocity. I have my doubts, but you know, the primary task is not to die of something stupid in the next 15 years. So give yourself a chance to see if it really happens or not.
No, super interesting. And as we talk age, one of your ambitious goals is to live to 120 years, right? And a variety of longevity techniques are emerging, from medications to prevent age-related diseases, the elimination of senescent cells, which are also better known as zombie cells, just hanging in the body and not kind of getting rid of it. The blood-plasma exchange, just to name a few. In your personal opinion, which of those methods do you consider most effective, but also would basically apply to yourself as your own kind of guinea pig?
I personally would try everything.
Okay.
To be honest, and just to have the experience and to judge and decide for myself. I have not done plasma exchange, and I didn't get any genetic treatment yet. Getting rid of zombie cells or senescent cells is very easy. You just have to fast, so not to eat anything at least for 3 days. You know, there are fasting mimicking diets. Walter Longo promoted that, so it's a it's a low-calorie diet, if you will, for 5 days, where your calorie intake is around 750 calories per day. Makes it much easier for, you know, the broader population to stick with that. So it's a fasting mimicking diet. You're under caloric for 5 days, and that helps with autophagy, getting rid of senescent cells, so the body heals itself, if you will. So that is easy, and it's doable for, you know, the majority of people. Where I'm focusing on is really prevention. So I do a colonoscopy every 5 years. Every year I go to my urologist to check on my prostate and my kidneys. Every year I go to an internal medicine specialist to check on all my other organs and do a comprehensive ultrasound examination. I do full body MRIs. I did genetic testing to see, you know, what genetic predispositions do I have. And unfortunately, you know, I'm predisposed to hypertension. This is why I'm wearing this little gadget here that measures my blood pressure all day, every day. Type 2 diabetes, meaning insulin resistance, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. The abbreviation is NAFLD. So I've obviously inherited all the bad stuff, but now I know I can actively, you know, take action against it. So the genetic testing, the full body MRI, and the so-called liquid biopsy. It's a test where you look for circulating tumor DNA or tumor cells in your blood as an early cancer detection test, if you will. So I'm focusing more on that, less on the other interventions like blood plasma exchange or, you know, gene therapy and other interventions.
So you optimize basically your knowledge about yourself, your monitoring habits that you have and related take action based on that, right? I mean, if we talk longevity, if we talk 100 plus, 120, whatever years, right? Now we're dying from cancer, cardiometabolic syndrome, heart attacks or whatever. I mean, what at that age, if we are 100, 120, what do you think will be the weakest link, the weakest part of our body that we have? Because we need to die at some point, eventually, for now at least, right? What do you consider is the weakest link? Is it the mind, the brain, the energy to live? Don't want to get too philosophic, but where do you see that? Or is it the muscle, the body itself, that it collapses? Where do you see this?
It's a very good question. I think we can work on strength and we'll be able to live a self-sustained life also, you know, beyond 100 years. So the 120 years is just the ambition. You know, if I get to 110 or 105,
fair enough, right?
Exactly, I achieve my goal. But I think it won't be muscle. You know, the funny thing is, if we were to cure cancer tomorrow, it only makes up 7% of the overall reduction in life expectancy. So you basically gain on average 5 years. Mm-hmm. Cardiovascular disease, I think this will be a big game changer if we can heal that in every aspect. But I think my biggest concern, and it's really more philosophical right now, is society. Mm-hmm. There is a large longitudinal study of students in Harvard. It's the Harvard Study of Adult Education, and it started in 1938. And Robert Waldinger is the third or fourth director of that study. Mm-hmm. It started off studying students that went to Harvard back then, wealthy white males. Mm-hmm. Now much more diverse, and they are studying, not only the students but the families and everybody that comes after them, on what makes them happy. Mm-hmm. They found out that if you have a meaningful other person, a partner, ideally, a lifelong partner, that is increasing your level of happiness. And the happier you are, the longer you live. But they observed also the opposite. So loneliness is just like smoking half a pack of cigarettes a day, or mm-hmm. being obese, and it also accelerates Alzheimer's. And with the way our society is behaving or evolving right now, with a lot of children glued to their smartphones, not spending time outside like I did when I was young, and basically spending more time alone than with others, I think that we're at risk of promoting loneliness when the next generation gets older. And that concerns me, and that troubles me. So I hope we'll find a way to let go of screens and be more interactive in the real world. Hmm.
And I thank you for that answer. A very, very open and honest answer. And that loneliness factor is probably something that I also meant with the energy to live, right? So what's your driver
exactly
for life? So will this deteriorate at some point once you hit a certain duration of life? Who knows, right? I'm intrigued to also ask, because what you're doing in terms of getting all the ultrasounds, the liquid biopsy testing, and the alike without repeating, this is all cost intense, of course, right? Our system is not set up for this. Yeah. Our system is set up as a sick care system where you have a symptom, you get a test, you get a solution, and that is reimbursed on a volume-based setup.
Yeah.
If we now talk longevity, preventative measures, this is value-based. This is not volume-based.
Sure.
But whatever you come out of some sort of application is going to be reimbursed. How can we make sure that what you can afford to test on yourself, mm-hmm. Can reach the broader mass? What type of changes do we need to see in health systems? Otherwise, people can afford it, but only few will.
Yeah.
And that is not going to have the big effect on society.
Yeah. I think, and I hope, it's like with many other things, it's a function of scale and volume. The more accessible it gets and the more people adopt it, mm-hmm. and maybe since we're here in Germany, it only needs one larger insurance company to take care of that. And I think there will be a ripple effect and others will follow. And then we'll have a broad accessibility to almost everybody. And which will continue to drive down cost, mm-hmm. which makes it more accessible to everybody. And right now, you're absolutely right. It's only accessible to a selected few that can afford it and that are willing to spend the money on.
And probably also taking a bit of a look into the future. In our recent strategy and future of health study, we do forecast that through a convergence of a disease care cycle, as we just alluded to, plus a well care cycle where it's more around keeping fit, knowing your genetic makeups, the water you drink, the air you breathe, and getting to know what you do in order to keep healthy. We're also predicting in this new business opportunities around preventative care, personalized nutrition and the like. And we're also seeing there that this will lead to a 2 to 3-fold increase in global well care market volume, creating a total value pool of 3.5 trillion by 2030. Mm. So it's a huge market, right? Compared to the, what is it, 11 to 12 trillion that we're spending currently on healthcare globally. So it's a huge market. If we would meet in, let's say, 5 years from now, where do you think we will see the greatest leapfrogs, especially in this wellcare cycle?
So I don't have a crystal ball.
Neither do I. But I have the luxury of having you as a guest today.
So this is just to preface my my answer. I think GLP-1 agonists, you know, do a great job of getting us there. And I hope that we'll have better control about genetic editing. You know, CRISPR-Cas technology is now being used, I think, in two indications, sickle cell anemia and B-cell lymphoma. Which are huge advancements. As we explore more safe use cases for that fantastic technology, I think this will leapfrog us into the next level. If we can address, you know, specific genetic issues that we can heal and solve for the better of humanity, I think this will be a game changer for us.
Having said that, Hadi, really a big thank you from my end for the very insightful personal hints that you gave, what you are doing to kind of get control over your body and take action based on that, but also the systems perspective on what needs to change to make that more broadly accessible as we just had. Really appreciate that. You gave me at least quite some inspiration on what to consider as of tomorrow. So big thanks for that.
Thank you very much for having me.
Super. So thank you very much to everyone for tuning into today's Strategy and Insider podcast. Please don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. We really appreciate your support and look forward to bringing you more thought-provoking episodes in the future. Until then, take care and bye-bye.
Strategy made real.